Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Wednesday, June 28, 2017. Last night, the New York City Rent Guidelines Board met to vote on rent increases for rent-stabilized apartments, despite testimony from hundreds of tenants and elected officials calling for a continued rent freeze or rollback. The RGB voted in favor of a 1.25% increase for tenants on one-year leases and a 2% increase for tenants on two-year leases. While it's the second lowest increase in the 48-year history of the RGB, it's still a big disappointment for tenants who are struggling to make ends meet. A special legislative session called by Governor Andrew Cuomo to resolve a stalemate over control of public education in New York City is off to a slow start. The 15-year-old policy expires on Friday if lawmakers do nothing. They ended their regular session last week without a deal. Today, they compiled a long wish list of other items that they want to address, including aid for upstate residents affected by recent flooding and emergency funding for the city's subway system. Other issues up for debate include help for a struggling upstate harness racetrack and casino, more speed cameras for New York City, the extension of county sales taxes, and the naming of the new Tappan Zee Bridge. Lawmakers are hoping to wrap up their work before the July 4th holiday weekend. Everything is on the table, says Senator Jeff Klein. What everyone is focused on, he said, is making sure mayoral control continues. Meanwhile, there's a growing list of lawmakers who are demanding action on the city's troubled subway system after another derailment yesterday. New York's MTA, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, says two supervisors were suspended while officials investigate the Harlem derailment that injured more than 30 people yesterday. MTA spokesperson Kevin Ortiz says the supervisors were responsible for oversight of work where the derailment occurred on Tuesday. They are suspended without pay during the formal review process. Two House Democrats want to compel the Air Force to detail how much has been spent on trips Donald Trump has made to his Florida estate and other properties that he and his family own. Arizona Representatives Tom O'Halloran and Ruben Gallego are planning to introduce an amendment tomorrow to the annual defense policy bill. It would require the Air Force to regularly submit presidential travel expense reports to Congress. Donald Trump says getting approval of a Senate health care bill will be very tough, but he predicts that Republicans will at least get very close and may get it over the line. He spoke today at the White House. He said his meeting with most of the Republican senators on Tuesday was tremendous. Meanwhile, the vote on the Republican Senate bill was delayed on Tuesday. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wouldn't have had the votes to push the bill designed behind closed doors with 12 other white men past key procedural hurdles. McConnell promises to revisit the legislation after Congress's July 4th recess. Today, mayors from around the country held a call on how the bill would affect their communities. The opioid crisis is front and center in their concerns. Mesa, Arizona Mayor John Giles is a Republican, but he says the issue is a bipartisan issue, that daily overdoses are tragedies occurring in the U.S., that mental health and addiction are not given the attention they so dramatically need.
When we have emergency medical providers that are being called upon to be the primary care providers in our communities, that is a bad model and that is an expensive model. I'm struck that the federal government in this situation is trying to run away from a burning building. That is not what cities do. That is not an option for the mayors of this country. Our cities and our public safety providers are the bottom tier safety net for those that we provide services to. I think the consensus is, and we can all agree, that Obamacare is flawed. We agree on that, but I need to point out that you don't fix something by making it worse.
Mayor Nan Whaley of Dayton, Ohio, says her community has been devastated by the opioid crisis.
I'm in Dayton, Ohio, where if this legislation passed, 469,000 Ohioans will see a total loss of their health care. Particularly in Ohio, of much concern, Ohio is number one in the nation for accidental overdose deaths in the country, number one in the nation. And in Dayton, we are at ground zero at that issue. In Ohio, if this bill passed, 220,000 Ohioans are receiving mental health or addiction services with Medicaid, with the Medicaid work, 4,000 alone in the county that I'm in. Imagine if this bill goes forward, 220,000 people without services that really saves their lives every single day.
Mayor Whaley says without Medicaid expansion, there's absolutely no place for those being treated to go. She says this is a life or death issue for people of Dayton, Ohio.
We have been able to estimate that the medical costs relating to addressing the effects of opiate addiction is costing my county of 96,000 people an estimated cost in excess of $100 million per year.
Mayor Steve Williams of Huntington, West Virginia.
That's for treating hepatitis B and C, endocarditis, the infection in and around the heart, neonatal abstinence syndrome babies. It's estimated that 20% of babies born in our community are fighting some level of addiction. When we look at that rate in our community of $100 million of healthcare costs per year, how that would translate to the nation at the same rate at 300, with our nation's population of 321 million, that translates to an annual healthcare cost across the nation of $334.8 billion a year just to fight the effects of the opiate epidemic.
Mayor Williams says gutting Medicaid for the most vulnerable people and those with pre-existing conditions spells economic disaster for his state, which is having a challenged budget. The West Virginia mayor says the Republican bill, which chooses not to be a full partner in fighting the opioid epidemic, is nothing short of political malpractice. Here's Bangor's mayor, Joe Baldacci.
We also have an opioid crisis like many other cities that is skyrocketing. In the state of Maine, which is about 1.3 million people, one person on average, one person per day, is dying from an opioid overdose. We have a state government that unfortunately does not listen and is not really a partner. So we need all the resources that we can. Here in northern and central Maine, it is generally an older population. It is a more rural population. And the opioid crisis happens here just like it happens in the big cities. In addition, the gutting of Medicaid is going to affect not only the ability for us to continue drug treatment resources, but also to care for senior citizens and disabled children. So we're very concerned about this bill on several levels.
There's also concern over in Anchorage, Alaska. That's where Mayor Ethan Berkowitz is reminded in the healthcare debate that mortality affects all, regardless of political affiliation.
Republicans get sick. Democrats get hurt, and what's going on in Washington, D.C. is not the way this debate should be waged. I mean, healthcare is fundamentally a problem that we're trying to solve together, not an issue to be won. And so when I listen to the rhetoric back and forth, I'm not seeing an emphasis on making sure that that we move the country forward, because America achieves greatness when we act together. And that's historically been the case, and that should be the case moving forward. I think there's a morality that's involved in protecting the most vulnerable amongst us. And as the Congress grapples with the issue, they should remember the things that truly make us a better place. I think as I listen to the discussion about the potential savings, there's a false economy in those budget numbers, because those budget numbers don't really amount to a savings or a cost shifting. They're a cost shifting to the private sector and to other levels of government. And I look at this, the impact of some of these healthcare proposals on Alaska. We have the highest cost of health delivery in the country by a long shot. And the elimination of some of the supports that would exist would cause massive problems for our population. We already suffer from a lack of health care, but if it becomes even more unaffordable, more people will suffer the consequences. And, in a small state and in a small city like Anchorage, these are not abstractions. These problems are personal. There's an intimacy to it, because if someone has an overdose, it's the son or the daughter of a friend, and it is intensely personal.
Mayor Berkowitz is urging Congress to remember the humanity that's involved in health care and to stop looking at it through partisan lenses, a view which is echoed by New York City's Mayor Bill de Blasio.
It's really powerful to note what we're hearing from all my colleagues is that the opioid crisis in particular has jolted this national health care discussion for good reason. It's something we're seeing in every part of our cities and states. It is a national crisis. It is equally urban and rural and suburban, but it's also very human and very personal. Mayor Berkowitz is right. People know, every mayor knows people, knows families that have lost someone, a loved one, to opioids. And this is adding to, I think, some of the bipartisan concern at the grassroots and the bipartisan anger at the notion that we would actually lose health care for people who need help right now. And as mayors are struggling to address this crisis, but imagine if we had a hand tied behind our back because it became a lot harder to connect people to care if it was much more expensive for people to get the help they need. I mean, right now, Medicaid is the lifeline for so many people. And if that's taken away, we're just going to lose more people to opioids. We're going to lose more young people. We're not going to have a place for them to turn for help. So you hear a lot of unity among the mayors because we understand life as it's lived on the ground, and the opioid crisis is one of the clearest examples of why we can't diminish of the availability of health care in America.
New York City's Mayor Bill de Blasio, along with other U.S. mayors from around the country in a bipartisan effort to discuss the health care bill and the opioid crisis affecting communities across the country. New York State's Attorney General Eric Schneiderman is threatening to file a lawsuit to block the implementation of the Republican health care overhaul. He says the evolving Senate bill violates women's constitutional rights by defunding Planned Parenthood, and that it also violates New York State's rights by targeting a New York-specific Medicaid provision. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica radio broadcasting at 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. A Brooklyn civic organization held a mayoral forum at the Clarendon Road Church in East Flatbush. Turnout was strong, both on and off the stage. 9 mayoral candidates were there. Nearly all are seeking the Democratic nomination. Expect that number to be smaller once the window for collecting 7,500 signatures closes on August 22nd. That's the number needed to be on the primary ballot. Matt Patterson went to the mayoral forum, and he files this report.
Much of the evening was devoted to Q&A, with the first round of questions coming from the moderators and the second hour directed by the audience. The major issues of the day included affordable housing and development, access to public education, and criminal justice reform. Several of the candidates gave impassioned responses when asked about police reform. Bob Ganji, a longtime activist working on criminal justice issues, was one of the most forceful in his denunciation of our current police practices. When asked about the right to know and right to record bills that aim to protect citizens from police misconduct, he said there's a lot more that should be done.
This legislation is positive, but does not get at the heart and root of the problem. The only thing that's going to change police misconduct and its discriminatory and abusive behavior is to significantly reduce the power, the money, and the personnel of the police department. Significantly.
Ganji's call to end the era of broken windows policing was echoed by Richard Bashner, a real estate lawyer who entered the race in May.
Why do we find enforcement so much stronger in communities of color than we do in white communities? When do we have amnesty for all the kids who were locked up for weed possession and for whatever else that's been going on in the discriminatory manner all these years?
Sal Albanese, an ex-city councilman who has run for mayor twice before, was more measured in his criticism of the police department. He spoke with pride about community policing initiatives he helped to establish while a council member. He said that though those initiatives were largely dismantled by Mayor Giuliani, he would work to continue their restoration.
We have a police department that is top flight. We do have some bad cops, like in every other profession. But bottom line is that the police, this police department is more diverse than it's ever been. It's a majority-minority police department. I want them working with the community. Police officers can keep communities safe when they're working together, and that's what I want them to do. I don't believe, by the way, that poor communities shouldn't get any policing. I think that, for example, in New York City Housing Authority, I would love to see the tenant association work with police officers.
Absolutely.
So that we can deal with some of the issues in NYCHA, because crime is up in NYCHA 5 or 6%. So I'm a big believer in community policing. I'm going to work with communities to work closely.
Sal Albanese was also the first to speak on the question of New York schools, and his sentiment was echoed by several candidates, including Bob Ganji and Richard Vashner.
I've always supported mayoral control because I believe that it builds in accountability, but I think what's happened is that parents have been cut out of the process. So I think we need a balance to make sure that the parents and communities have a voice. I do support mayoral control with more community input. As far as charters are concerned, I would lift the cap with some conditions.
Support for mayoral control of the public schools was nearly unanimous. The issue of charter schools, however, turned out to be divisive. Candidates Albanese, Ganji, and Bashner all asserted that they would consider raising the cap on charter schools, but only with conditions regarding salaries and access. Another candidate, Colin Slattery, runs a digital marketing company and is the youngest mayoral candidate at 28 years old. He took a different stance, which got one of the wildest audience reactions of the evening.
I guess I'm unique here on this panel in that I am completely anti-charter school. Charter schools, all the research has shown, they're more expensive, they don't have better results. We need to take all that money we're wasting on charter schools and put it back into the public school system.
Slattery also roused the crowd on the issue of affordable housing.
One of the things we need to do is make sure that predatory landlords aren't taking affordable housing out of the system, harassing tenants, harassing them in court, and moving these affordable units and turning them into market rate units by kicking people out. That's one problem. And another problem is the fact that the city gives away its land to developers without focusing on affordable housing. I live in Crown Heights. There's the Bedford Armory, which is being converted into housing. And the city is giving it away to developers. Instead of converting it into 100% affordable housing, it's a lot of market rate units. It's gentrifying the neighborhood. The city should not be giving away its property for the profits of developers.
Bob Ganji and Sam Albanese both spoke out against the greed of real estate developers as well, with Albanese explicitly pledging to accept no campaign contributions from real estate developers or lobbyists. Out of all the candidates, it was, unsurprisingly, the real estate lawyer Richard Bashner who had the most concrete policy proposals to deal with the city's housing crisis. In his initial statements, he spoke to the relationship between temporary and affordable housing, as well as suggesting the legalization of existing basement and attic units. On his second pass at the topic, he spoke to funding and alternative housing models.
And it's hard because there's no money. So if you're not going to accept luxury rentals to pay for it, you need some other funding source. So what can we look to? Right now for industrial projects, we have industrial revenue bonds that are triple tax exempt. So people buy the bonds are used to build industrial properties. We have something similar for school construction, for dormitory housing, but we don't have the same thing for affordable housing, and we don't have the same thing for shelter housing. In terms of what type of housing, I'm looking at a sort of, I don't know how many folks are familiar with the business WeWork or WeLive, which is smaller rooms, but in a nicer facility where you have better common space and all kinds of other amenities. And in that type of situation, you can have add-on services for people who can't take care of themselves and need assistance.
By early August, we will find out which of these candidates can garner enough signatures and community support to be on the ballot. The primary election, when some of these candidates will face off against incumbent Mayor Bill de Blasio, will take place on September 12th. Thanks to the Ernest Skinner Political Association for organizing the Mayoral Forum. Follow them on Facebook to find out about upcoming political events. Matt Patterson, WBAI News, New York.
Today, in a surprise statement, Republican Paul Massey dropped his bid for mayor of New York City. This leaves Assemblymember Nicole Meliotakis of Staten Island the presumptive nominee for Republicans to take on incumbent Democrat Bill de Blasio this fall. In other news, there is finally some movement in the case of the 28-year-old Mohammed Ba, who was killed by NYPD police officers back on September 25, 2012. On that day, NYPD officers arrived on the scene after Ba's mom, Hawa Ba, called 911 to request an ambulance for her son. He was in physical and emotional distress. Emergency service unit officers forced their way into the apartment against NYPD protocol and without a warrant, with guns drawn. The NYPD has long contended that Mohammed Ba came at officers with a knife when they arrived at his apartment, forcing them to shoot. No evidence, though, of a knife has been presented. The officer shot Mohammed Ba 8 times. Evidence show the last shot was fired at close range. U.S. District Judge Kevin Castell, who is overseeing the Ba civil case, ordered a hearing regarding possible destruction of NYPD evidence and other evidence in the case. The Ba family, the Justice Committee, faith leaders, and community members are requesting supporters to pack the court at 10 a.m. tomorrow. That's at 500 Pearl Street, courtroom 11D in Manhattan. In other news, in the case of Laquan McDonald, on Tuesday, 3 Chicago police officers were indicted on felony charges that they conspired to cover up actions of a white police officer who shot and killed the 17-year-old. The indictment says the officers lied when they alleged the teenager aggressively swung a knife at officers and attempted to get up from the ground still armed with the knife after he was shot. In the indictment, which was approved Monday and announced yesterday, a Cook County grand jury alleges that one current and two former officers lied about the events of October 20, 2014, when Officer Jason Van Dyke shot the black teen 16 times. The narrative of the officers contradict what can be seen on police dash cam video, in which the teen can be seen spinning after he was shot and falling to the ground as the officer continues to fire shots into his body. The indictment further alleges that officers lied when they said McDonald ignored Van Dyke's verbal commands and that one of the officers reviewed a report that claimed the other two officers were, in fact, victims of an attack by McDonald. According to the indictment, the co-conspirators created police reports in the early hours and days following the killing of Laquan McDonald that contained important false information in an attempt to prevent or shape any criminal investigation. And this week, on the floor of the House of Representatives, Congressmember Lacey Clay from Ferguson, Missouri, rose to decry police violence against community members. He spoke out at first in the name of Philando Castile.
The chair now recognizes the gentleman from Missouri, Mr. Clay, for 5 minutes.
I rise today to mourn the death of my former constituent, Philando Castile, whose shocking and completely unnecessary death has now been seen by millions around the world via video. I mourn not only his death, but also the complete failure of local law enforcement and the criminal justice system to protect his most precious right, the right to life. Philando, like so many other young African Americans before him, interacted with local law enforcement, responded peacefully, did exactly what he was supposed to do, and yet he wound up dead, shot 6 times at point blank range by an officer who saw him as something less than human. He is dead for no good reason, except for the color of his skin and the fact that his ethnicity fed into an implicit, sick, and deadly bias held by some police officers that black people present an imminent threat simply by virtue of who we are. And that bias is pervasive, not just among some police officers, but also throughout our criminal justice system. Anyone who views the video of Philando's police shooting can see that he should not be dead, and that the officer who killed him should have been held accountable. But as in far too many other cases, the justice system failed Philandro and his family in the most outrageous way. The sad truth is that in 2017, we continue to suffer under a justice system that provides justice for some, but not for all. As I join with Philandro's family and millions of other Americans who are outraged by the complete lack of accountability for his death, I could not but help remember another tragic case, the death of my 18-year-old constituent, Mike Brown, almost 3 years ago in Ferguson, Missouri. And as I watched Philandro's family screaming out for justice, they reminded me of something that Mike Brown's mother, Leslie McSpadden, told me. She said, "Congressman, I want them to know that he mattered to me." Well, he mattered to me too, as well as Philandro. So did Tamir Rice, Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, Freddie Gray, and so many others who have died at the hands of local police for no good reason, without any consequences. Mr. Speaker, I have supported local law enforcement for over 30 years, and I continue to have no doubt that the vast majority of police officers perform a difficult, dangerous, and essential job with honor, bravery, and integrity. But I also know that too many other officers clearly lack the temperament and training to de-escalate interactions before they become deadly, and that continues to cost many innocent lives. That's why I've introduced, along with my good friends, Congressman Steve Cohen and Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois, the Police Training and Independent Review Act of 2017. This legislation has already earned almost 100 co-sponsors. My bill would protect both police officers and the citizens they serve. It would require sensitivity training in the areas of race, ethnic bias, disabilities, and interactions with new immigrants. It would also establish incentives to encourage states to adopt new laws to require an independent prosecutor in all cases when police use deadly force. This legislation deserves a fair hearing and an up or down vote in this House. I will close with this, a brief teaching from the late Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. on the occasion of another needless tragedy, the police killing of civil rights worker Jimmie Lee Jackson by an Alabama state trooper in 1965. In his eulogy, King says a state trooper pointed the gun, but he did not act alone. And, Mr. Speaker, I yield back.
Congressmember Lacey Clay on the House floor this week. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Wednesday, June 28, 2017. The news was produced with Matt Patterson and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.